Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is a special edition of On Point before a live audience at the Paramount Theater in Boston. We are celebrating 10 great years of the show, our 10th anniversary. To our wonderful guests in the hall and listeners around the country, welcome to On Point. These are hard, confusing days for the USA. The can-do country looks back on its heels, tangled up in truly daunting challenges. Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Thomas Friedman takes them on. Political gridlock, global competition, giant deficits. He's ready for some shock therapy. This hour On Point, we'll hear it. Thomas Friedman on how to make America great again. We're recording this special show before a live audience in the Paramount Theater in downtown Boston. We'll be taking questions from our audience here and from our national audience, which has chipped in questions at our website, onpointradio.org, and on Facebook and Twitter at On Point Radio. Joining me now on stage is New York Times columnist and three-time Pulitzer Prize winner Thomas Friedman, author of the bestsellers From Beirut to Jerusalem, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, The World is Flat and More, a commanding global voice in a radically globalized world. He's just authored with the great Johns Hopkins foreign policy guru Michael Mandelbaum their lively opus on this country and its future now. It's titled That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. Tom Friedman, welcome. Congratulations on the new book and thank you for helping us celebrate our 10th anniversary.
Tom, it's great to be here. I've been on the show, you know, many times over the years, and it's a treat to do this in person with you.
It's terrific to have you. It is just terrific, and this is an important time. You raise issues on just about as big a scale as they can be raised. It's something that presidents do sometime, and I want to just get the music of that over time in our ears. At a speech at Rice University, September 1962, President John F. Kennedy spoke about his decision to send American astronauts to the moon and more.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win, and the others too.
And the others, too, and the crowd applause. And there's a challenge from a president of the United States, 1962, 1984. Find the arc here. Listen for it. In his speech to the Republican National Convention, President Ronald Reagan spoke about America's bright future, eternally bright.
She has arms big enough to comfort and strong enough to support. For the strength in her arms is the strength of her people. She will carry on in the 80s unafraid, unashamed, and unsurpassed. In this springtime of hope, some lights seem eternal. America's is.
America's is. Flash forward on that light. Last year, November 3rd, 2010, President Barack Obama spoke to the nation after those midterm elections. Forget eternity. Listen for the punchline.
It makes no sense for China to have better rail systems than us and Singapore having better airports than us. And we just learned that China now has the fastest supercomputer on Earth. That used to be us.
That used to be us. It's the title of Tom Friedman's new book with Michael Mandelbaum. That used to be us. Tom Friedman, what happened?
What happened? A lot of things happened, Tom. Not one thing overnight. Let me toss out a few broad themes. The first thing that happened was we misinterpreted the end. We did the worst thing a species or a country can do. We misinterpreted our environment. At the end of the Cold War, we thought the Cold War end was a victory, and surely it was a great victory. But it was also the onset of the biggest challenge we'd ever faced in our lifetime. We had just unleashed 2 billion people just like us with the same dreams and aspirations. An enormous pent-up energy. And just when we needed to actually be retying our shoes and engaging them in a new competition and collaboration, we kind of put our feet up. We compounded it a decade later, right when you started this show, by tragically spending the last decade spending enormous amount of energy chasing the losers from globalization, called Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, rather than the winners. On top of that, we had a generational shift. We went from the greatest generation that believed in save and invest to a baby boomer generation. Michael and I are both baby boomers. I think you are too. That believed in a lot more in borrow and spend. We went from a generation that believed in sustainable values, values that literally sustain, as our teacher Dov Seidman says, to a generation that believes more in situational values. You do whatever the situation allows. Just do it. If the situation allows me to give Tom Ashbrook $1 million subprime mortgage and he can only show me $10,000 in income and all I've asked you is, can you fog up a knife? I do it. The situation says, okay, even though sustainable values would tell me I should. And lastly, our politics has become completely broken. We are no longer able to produce optimal solutions or even near optimal solutions. Our political system, for a variety of reasons, we can talk about them, can not only produce suboptimal outcomes. How long do you remain a great country when your politics can only produce suboptimal outcomes?
You look at all this, we read it in the pages of your new book, and it is stupendously daunting. You and Michael Mandelbaum call yourselves frustrated optimists. The frustration, I think everybody listening to this right now can understand. The optimism is sometimes harder to hang on to. I mean, you see how attitudes about this country are changing within this country. People want it to be great, but the certainty that you heard in Ronald Reagan, or the wish or wish fulfillment, call it what you will, much less universally held now. But you've got that word right in your self-description, and let's go straight to us. With all that, that long list, and we're going to dive into that, what is it that brings you back to the point of optimism, and can you really defend that against all the weight of this weighty book?
It's a very good question. And wherever we go, people ask us, and they sort of look at the title and pick up the cover, and they say, but does it have a happy ending? And we always tell everyone, oh, it does, absolutely. We just don't know whether it's fiction or nonfiction. And that really will depend on us. But optimism is enforced, and it really comes from, I'll speak for myself here, from two sources. One, where I came from. I grew up in Minnesota in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The year I graduated high school in 1971, Minnesota was on the cover of Time magazine with Wendell Anderson, the governor of the state, holding up a walleye that he had just caught under the title, The State That Works. So I grew up in a place where politics really works. My senators were called McCarthy, Mondale, Humphrey. My congressmen were both liberal Republicans named Frenzel and McGregor. My corporations were called Dayton and Honeywell and Control Data, corporations that thought it was their obligation to build and fund the Tyrone Guthrie Theater, where I grew up. You know, a lot of my work, I mean, if you put me on the couch, is really sort of Minnesota boy goes to Beirut, you know. I mean, it's I bring that optimism, you know, wherever I go. So that's for me. And Michael, who grew up in California, will tell you the same. Where it also comes from, though, and it's not contrived, is my own reporting. And the third to last chapter in this book is called They Just Didn't Get the Word. And it really is stories of what always makes me an optimist about this country. It is still full of people who just didn't get the word. They didn't get the word that we're down and out. They didn't get the word that we're in a slow decline. They didn't get the word that we're in a recession. And they go out and start stuff and fix stuff and heal stuff and organize stuff. And whether it's in Wall Street today or in places you've never seen before. You know, I started this book tour. I went to Quinnipiac University up in Connecticut and sat down with the president. He said, I said, what's new here? And he said, well, we just started a medical school. I said, you didn't get the word. I mean, you just started a medical school? Who starts a medical school in the middle of a recession? But the country's full of that. And I wrote about this when I did my previous book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, because I would go around the country talking about energy and giving energy talks. Afterwards, I'd sign books. People would come up and they would tell me all their stories about, I got this invention. I got a duck. It paddles a wheel, blows up a balloon, issues methane, turns a turbine. I hear the craziest stuff. And then they'd leave me their business cards. You know, I go back to my room after a book signing, and I empty my pocket of business cards. I always tell people, you know, rock stars get room keys. I get business cards. But they're very, they're exciting in their own way, because what they tell you is that the country is alive. If you want to be an optimist about America, stand on your head, okay? Because there is just a huge thrust coming from below. And as I've said, ad infinitum, it looks just like the space shuttle taking off. All that thrust coming from below, but unfortunately right now, our booster rocket, Washington, D.C., is cracked and leaking energy.
Okay.
And the pilots in the cockpit are fighting over the flight plan.
Okay, Tom Friedman of Minnesota, Andy of Mayberry, we hear that innate optimism, and you've looked at it from the bottom up, and we're delighted you see that, but I read the headlines on your column, and I always ask myself, as facile as you are with the language, how is Tom Friedman going to crank up the alarm even higher? Because they just get more and more and more urgent. In fact, I don't know how you find the language to take it up higher. I don't know how much higher your volume could go. You're saying it's code red, ladies and gentlemen, in 16 different ways.
Yep.
This is not a joke, the set of challenges that we're up against.
No, you're right, Tom, and there is that optimism. This is why we call ourselves frustrated optimists. But I'll also be really honest with you. I've never been more worried about the country. Because the combination, we're driving around the world right now without a bumper or a spare tire. We use that to get out of, the recession a few years ago. So if we go into a double dip now, and we start at 9.2 or 9.1% unemployment, we start with already having, spent nearly $1 trillion to get where we are. We got a real problem. Because if you look at the world today, you see America is going through this huge struggle, to get itself back fiscally in order. Europe is going through this huge struggle. The Arab world is going through this huge struggle. And China is going through this huge struggle. So the four key pillars of the global economy are all going through this struggle, and we've never been more interconnected.
We've begun to set the table with Tom Friedman. His new book with Michael Mandelbaum is That Used to Be Us. I'm Tom Ashbrook with a special 10th anniversary edition of the show before a live audience in Boston. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook before a live audience of public radio supporters at the Paramount Theater in Boston celebrating 10 years of On Point. My guest this hour is three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, journalist, Thomas Friedman of the New York Times. He and Michael Mandelbaum are out with a new book. It's titled That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. They call themselves frustrated optimists. They say they see a way. I'll tell you up front, not to spoil, not to give away the punchline, it's a narrow way. And they tell us that the time is not unlimited. And there may be people in this hall and around this country that wonder if the way they describe can be achieved. No small part of it depends on a third party. Power rising in this country will come to it. Tom Friedman is next to me right here on the stage, and we're so glad to have him. I've got questions coming in from the audience, and you around the country have been good enough to send them in online already. Tom, you say that our great failure since the Cold War is our misinterpretation of the environment around us. So give it to us. Give us your Tom Friedman view. We see your bylines, your datelines from all over the world. Paint that global environment. If it's a big challenge and we've got to get on top of it, paint it as you see it right now, eyes wide open.
Well, let me talk about three key challenges that I think we face today. The first is the merger of globalization and the IT revolution. That's a big education challenge, and I'll talk about that in detail. The second is debt and deficit, entitlements. We're all familiar with that. And the third is energy and climate, how we power our growth in a way that also doesn't tilt the planet into disruptive climate change. So let's talk about the first, the merger of globalization and the IT revolution, which we call the Great Inflection. And it's something that is not really being talked about much, Tom, understandably, because other things are more grabbing of the headlines. But it's actually a huge development. So when I, as you know, because we talked about it, you had me on the show. In 2004, I started working on a book called The World is Flat. And it basically was about the interconnectedness of the world. The book came out in 2005, but it started out in 2004. So when we went to work on this book, I went back to that book and just to sort of think about where we were then and where we are now. And I looked in the index under F, first edition of The World is Flat. And Facebook wasn't in it. And, as I say in the book, when I sat down to write The World is Flat, Facebook, for most people, didn't exist. Twitter was a sound. The cloud was in the sky. 4G was a parking place. LinkedIn was a prison. Applications were what you sent to college. And for most people, Skype was a typo.
You've got a hip-hop future, Tom. You've got a hip-hop future.
So think about that. I mean, all of that just happened, basically, after I said, the world's flat. You know, okay? So
it got flatter.
It got flatter. It went from connected to hyper-connected. So what does that mean? What it means is your boss and mine now have access to more cheap software, highly productive automation, and not just cheap labor, but cheap genius than ever before. So the whole global curve has actually risen. You know, we have a little anecdote from, not maybe it was a little item in the New York Times.
I hate that phrase, cheap genius, by the way.
Cheap genius, yeah. It's scary. You know, a lot of people say to me, easy for you to say, Mr. Columnist, New York Times. No, you don't understand, okay? I actually inherited James Reston's office at the New York Times. Mm-hmm. What a great honor. Mm-hmm. A great columnist in the 60s and 70s. And I suspect when Mr. Reston came to the office, he would say to himself, I wonder what my seven competitors are going to write today. And he actually knew all seven. Walter Lippmann, Mary McGrory, Stuart Alsop. I do the same thing. I come to the office and say, I wonder what my 70 million competitors will write today.
Every blogger in the universe.
Every blogger, every columnist, if I'm writing about India, and the Hindustan Times is now a competitor. Mm-hmm. So what's happened, you know, another story, we have, and this is from the New York Times reported just a few months ago, that Grinnell College in Iowa, small liberal arts college in
great
the middle
school.
Of Iowa, great school, my mother-in-law went there, 1,600 students. This year, 10% of the applications to Grinnell College came from China. Of those 10%, 50% had perfect 800s on their math SATs. So, like, when I talk about the world is flat, metaphorically, you are competing. You know, now your kids and mine are literally competing with the high school students at Shanghai PS21. And so the whole global curve has risen now. And that is a huge education challenge for the country.
Globalization, NIT, ties that in. It puts it right in our lap. It puts it right in our face. You go straight to education from there. And this has been a huge rock. I mean, everybody says this is fundamental. We can't win in this flat world or any shape world you like these days if we don't do it right. And yet we've talked about it and talked about it and talked about it, and it doesn't seem to get better. Why?
Well, you know, I think part of it is because my wife's a school teacher and my daughter did Teach for America and is a school teacher in D.C. So we talk about this a lot. And I have a good view of this world through them. And part of it is because everyone's got their perfect solution. Just get rid of the teachers union. Well, that'll solve it, you know. Or, you know, keep the teachers union or charter schools or smaller class. And the fact is, you know, where we come out in the book is the following. We definitely want to create a world where we attract teachers from the highest end of every graduating class. I'm of that generation who benefited in a reverse way from the absence of women's liberation. So we had all these incredibly talented women who couldn't get jobs elsewhere teaching. And,
and
some of them were my teachers. And as the marketplace opened up, blessedly for women to go into all these different careers, fewer and fewer of the best and the best, you know, went into teaching because they had so many other opportunities. So we need to get back to that, that's for sure. And we certainly need to work with the unions on a system of rating teachers and weeding out the bad and promoting and enriching and rewarding the best. There's no question about that. But all these problems I laid out are the three big ones. Education, which is the IT revolution, you know, how we need to deal with it. Debt and deficit and environment. What they all have in common is this. They all require collective action. We cannot deal with any of these without collective action, and that's precisely what we've lost. So what's the collective action we need? Yes, we need better teachers, but you know, we need better parents. Parents who take a constant interest in what their kids are doing in school and how they're learning. We need better neighbors. Neighbors who care about their public school, whether their kids in them or not. We need better politicians who are interested in raising education standards, not dumbing them down. We need better business leaders who care about the education in their where their factory is, and not just say, well, if it's not here, I'm going to go overseas. And lastly, we need better students who understand that they are competing with those kids from PS21, and they better come to school ready to learn, not to text.
Tell that story and lay it right out, and we hear that. I mean, we're leaning more and more heavily on your frustrated optimism, on your optimism as we go. Let's go to debt and deficit. We've got a super committee.
Yeah.
It's already sat down. It's supposed to produce something before Thanksgiving to get us some kind of first big foot on a rung of some kind of ladder on getting on top of debt and deficit. And already the Speaker of the House has said no new taxes, and the President has said, you know, he's got his own limits here. He's got his own red lines. I mean, do we have any handle on this debt, and can we hope to address the others if we don't address this one? How do you come at it?
Oh, I picked a bad day to stop sniffing glue, I'll tell you that. I mean, it's...
Can we get Tom some glue?
Yeah. Let me start with what we need, and then I'll go into the argument. We need a grand bargain. Okay.
We almost had one. We were told right. last summer. I don't know exactly. if we really did or not.
We need a three-part deal. We need to a bargain that, first of all, provides some short-term stimulus that also works on these things that the country needs, whether schools, infrastructure, whatnot, but also provides a kind of WPA-like stimulus. Because clearly, we are in danger of a double dip. Second thing we need, though, is a long-term plan to deal with debt, deficit, entitlements, and spending in a way that will be truly credible and at the scale of the problem. Okay, and that means we need to also raise revenue. We need to reform the tax code in a way that will both raise revenue and simplify it. And there's just and everybody's got to pay. We need those three
and
things.
And I've read you, by revenue, you mean taxes, but you've got a message in here for Democrats, too. You're looking straight at Social Security and Medicare, and you're saying not inviolable.
Oh, absolutely. We've got to. So my vision is that I think we need a – let me start with what I think we need. Mm-hmm. We need a plan that has four elements. One, it really addresses these fiscal issues at the scale of the problem, and the scale is huge. Number two, it does it in a fair way. The rich pay more, but everybody pays something, and we cut defense – and Social Security and Medicare, and we, you know, it's across the board. It doesn't just come out of entitlements, it doesn't just come out of defense, we cut it across the board. Third, it's got to be a plan that I believe is honest about the time frame. We didn't get into this overnight, Tom. We're not getting out of it overnight, okay? And we need to be honest with people about that. And lastly,
honest with bondholders, creditors, who are we being honest with?
Honest with the public. This is going to hurt. We're either going to have a hard decade or a bad century. Okay, we're either going to roll up our sleeves and get through this decade, or we're going to limp into the 21st century. But lastly, I think this plan also has to be aspirational, that it's about making this country great. It isn't just about solving a fiscal crisis, okay? So it's got to wrap all four in. And so in my column in today's New York Times, I quote Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles as making a really interesting point in an essay they did in the Washington Post last week. What they said was, the more we asked, the bigger we made the plan, the more Democrats and Republicans we got on board. Because I really believe Americans will sign up for a plan they think that really solves the problem, is really fair, and has a big aspiration to it. And I don't think either party has given them that.
I'm all for the aspiration. We need it. Adults are fired up by it. Children are fired up by it. And we haven't spoken in those right. terms with enough vigor.
Yeah.
But let's put the two angles
Please.
To you here. First, for the Democrats, because there they are. And you're saying that used to be us as the title. But I'm not sure if the Social Security and Medicare, for example, that you're going to end up with, or you would imagine, is what we used to be. I mean, how big a cut? Is this tinkering? Is this tweaking? Sometimes people say that's all you have to do. It sounds to me like you're saying something deeper, something more. How much right. of what people have counted on, invested in, worked toward, do you think is going to have to be gone?
I'm a Simpson-Bowles guy. We're going to have to raise the age. That's the quickest, easiest math fix.
Is it enough?
They think it's enough. They think it's enough to get nearly $4 trillion out of, among other things,
yeah.
along with other things,
yeah.
along with tax increases,
yeah, yeah,
along
yeah.
with, you know, defense cuts, along with a gasoline tax,
yeah.
That will keep our debt-to-GDP ratio in a safe range.
At raise the age, too.
I think they talked about 67 in Medicare, and I forgot what it is I have.
Yeah. So that's hard, but it's not the end of the world.
No, it's not the end of the world. It's a math problem. And by the way, all the other alternatives are really hard. See, Tom, we are going to do this. Either, you know, that's what we have to realize. Either we're going to do it, the market's going to do it, Mother Nature's going to do it, or the middle's going to do it. That's the middle of America. But it is going to be done. Now, if we do it with a plan, that's like going to the dentist and getting your rotten tooth taken out with Novocaine, professional dentist, tooth comes out, it's okay. If we don't do it, if we let the market do it, that's like having a caveman do your dental work with stone tools, okay? The tooth will come out, I trust, you know. But the tooth will come out, and so will four other teeth around it, and there'll be blood all over the floor.
And we're on our way to that right now. You yeah. quote Jeff Bridges from Crazy Heart, the movie. His song, his country song in there. Funny how fallen feels like flying for a little while. There's still a kind of denial here, as you describe
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Terms of our debate.
Well, you know, one of my great environmental teachers, Rob Watson, who invented the whole LEED building concept, Rob always, you know, likes to say that, you know, if you jump off the top of an 89-story building, For 79 floors, you can think you're flying. It's the sudden stop at the end that tells you you're not, you know. And that's where we are. We are just begging for a sudden stop at the end.
Yeah, you go to revenues too, and that means taxes, and you say they've got to go up. But Americans, Republicans say, why?
Well, okay, let's say we don't. You know, we, as we know, the Republicans, August 11th, they had a debate. All their candidates were out there. They were asked, would you accept $10 in spending cuts and just $1 in tax increases to solve this problem?
10 to 1.
10 to 1, and every one of them said no. That's a sign of the apocalypse. You know, I mean, that means, you know, because you realize if we don't get those $10 in tax cuts, do you know what your in spending cuts? Do you know what your taxes are going to be? Do you realize how much more your taxes are going to have to go up?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to support
this. You're saying
this,
that's a great deal.
That's a great deal. And when people feel, no, I've signed a pledge to some knucklehead out there that we don't even know, that I can't, you know, that I can't do this, you know, it's just, I mean, that's just abdicating your leadership, your judgment in a rapidly changing world. And you just cannot behave that way.
There's an alternative vision out there, and it's expressed even in response to your book. In the Wall Street Journal,
yep.
Andrew Ferguson
sure.
writes about your optimism.
Right.
He writes, it's terrifying. And it's a right-wing view, he says.
Yeah.
It's a conservative view, that because you are calling, you are saying, we've taken collective action on big things before. We've had big aspirations, and we've followed through in a big way through collective action. And both of those phrases, big mm-hmm. things, he underlines, collective action, he underlines. He says, that means the federal government, no thank you. That is the way to Solyndra. That is the way to failure. That is the way to... We won't make it, Tom Friedman.
Yeah, right.
Well,
let me
the House
that.
Of Representatives
right.
as well,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. And there is that view out there that... I did this all by myself. I got here, Tom, all by myself. You know, we quote, you know, Bob Inglis, the Republican congressman in South Carolina. A guy stood up at one of his town hall meetings during the campaign and said, keep your government hands off my Medicare. Okay? I mean, I did this all. You didn't do anything by yourself. You did this thanks to the greatest public-private partnership in the history of the world. Did you make that airport by yourself? Did you make that road by yourself? Did you build those schools by yourself that you were educated in? I was educated in public schools, as far as I know. My parents didn't build that by themselves. What made the country great was a balance between a great public sector and a great harnessing the energy and unleashing the energy of that private sector.
But you know there's opposition to that right now. It's strong in the Tea Party. It's strong in the House of Representatives. It's strong in the Senate where you need 60 votes. Let's go to a first question from our listeners. How do you get out of this? If you're right, why isn't that being articulated? Peter, Jamaica Plain writes, a lot of these suggestions seem to require political leadership. Yet our political system seems as broken as ever. What's going to fix that? Who's going to raise up this megaphone and speak the kind of message you're speaking here in a way that doesn't just become another piece of partisan gridlock?
Well, you know, we're just speaking between the two of us. So
yeah.
Don't tell anyone
okay.
this. But
okay,
just between
yeah.
I voted for Barack Obama. I'm not supposed to say that. Okay, so
okay.
I voted for Obama, and I voted for him for one reason. I thought he would change the polls, not read the polls.
That's a Friedman line.
Okay, that's why I voted for him. And
here we are.
And what do I mean?
But here we
so
are.
What do I mean? So he and Boehner tried to do a grand bargain, and Boehner says Obama raised the stakes after they had a deal. Obama says Boehner walked out because he couldn't actually get the Tea Party base. What's my critique of the president
mm-hmm.
on this?
Mm-hmm.
If I were really for a grand bargain, and I thought that's what the country needed, I'd have picked up the phone after Boehner left. I'd have said, please get me Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles on the phone. I'd have said, Erskine, Alan, hitch up, you know, the wagon. The three of us, we're going on a national tour. We're going across this country, and we're going to sell Simpson Bowles and the grand bargain, and on 3 to 1, you know, that's what they were
mm-hmm,
talking about, $3
mm-hmm.
in spending, $1 mm-hmm. in taxes, and we are going to sell it to the country. What happened? No, all we heard was, well, they kind of were talking about a grand bargain. Mm-hmm. We didn't kind of know the details, you know,
mm-hmm.
and then grand bargain, and then we didn't really know the details, and then poof, it went away.
Why? If you're saying he read the polls, and the polls tell you somehow that it would have worked,
yeah.
why didn't we see it? You get 20 seconds before the break.
Because his job was to change the polls, not read the polls. And you had to take that to the country. That's the job of leadership.
It wasn't there. We're going to talk about where it might come from with Tom Friedman. He and Michael Mandelbaum are out with a new book that used to be us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. I'm Tom Ashbrook with a special 10th anniversary edition of the show before a live audience in Boston. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook before a live audience of public radio supporters at the Paramount Theater, Boston, celebrating 10 years of On Point. My guest, Thomas Friedman, three-time Pulitzer Prize winner, bestseller after bestseller. He and Michael Mandelbaum, big foreign policy thinker, big as they get, have sat down, looked at the world, looked at this country, and tried to describe a way forward in it. That used to be us. They're talking about others. Today. They're talking about China. They're talking about India, maybe Brazil. What about this country and where we're headed now and what's it going to take to get it back on track? Tom Friedman joins me here before a live audience. We've got questions from them and from you via the website onpointradio.org and Facebook and Twitter from around the country. Let's start diving in here, Tom. We've got a listener who wants names put on this. All right. You say, you put it right that out there. You voted for Barack Obama. He is reading the polls, not driving the country that you say the way you'd like to see it done. You're calling for something different to go on here. You're calling specifically for a third-party presidential candidate to step up and somehow part the waters and lead this country, across the sea to the promised land. And this listener wants to know. We'll get to how that might work, but you put this in any order you wanted, how or who. But they want to know who. Who is going to do that? It wasn't Ross Perot. It wasn't, at least so far, Barack Obama. You didn't like what you saw in that display of hands at the Republican debate on 10-to-1 spending cuts versus a little more taxation. The listener wants to know, who's it going to be, Tom Friedman? Is this a magic, puff the magic dragon person?
Sure. Well, in fairness, what we actually say is not what we have to have a third party. What we say is we're going to have a third party or we're going to need a third party if the two parties can't come to the agenda that we need.
Yeah.
And we've been very specific about this. We don't have a candidate. We have an agenda, okay? And what we're saying is we're for... I mean, it's not a cop-out.
They're looking to get going.
We're for whatever candidate actually supports, this agenda. And, right now, again, the column I did today really makes this point, which is that I'm very sorry Governor Christie dropped out of the race.
Why?
Because Governor Christie was for Simpson Bowles. He did not accept that 10-to-1. He would not have raised his hand, in supporting that.
You sure? You're absolutely sure?
Well, that's
even
he,
with the Klieg lights
That's what
on?
He says. That's,
okay.
All I'm saying is that's what he says.
Okay.
And what I think would have been really healthy is had he run and had he, garnered support, he would have yanked at least a part of the Republican Party to the center. I think that would have forced Obama back to the center. And then we'd have a race, ideally, between the center right and center left, which would assure one thing. It would be about the grand bargain, and whichever candidate won would actually have a mandate to actually implement it. If the far left and far right set the agenda of the two parties, there's two things I will tell you for sure. The party that wins will win by 50.0001% of the vote, and it will have a mandate to do nothing. Okay.
The thing we cannot afford.
The thing we can't afford.
The clock is ticking.
Absolutely.
So you're describing somebody, unnamed, they stand up between this right and this left, and they lay it out, a kind of serious description, as you describe it here, of the world, and they link that to their budget plans and the whole picture, and in that moment, this kind of amazing moment, the other parties stand and listen in awe, and you say, you describe them, they then have to step up, maybe to the center, or risk appearing cowardly, ignorant, deluded, or duplicitous, or all four in the eyes of tens of millions of voters who were watching.
Well,
of voters are watching and listening now, and so nobody's feeling crowbarred into your agenda at the moment.
So let's, the way you read that, Tom, is if this is pure fantasy, we're actually just citing history. Ross Perot did this with Bill Clinton and George Bush Sr. He at one point had 40% of the polls. Okay, he won 20%, 19 point something. And we all know at the end, he got a little kooky, Ross Perot. He nevertheless,
with respect,
what was his exactly? What was his impact? He made Bill Clinton a deficit reducer. Okay? Ross Perot set the agenda for the country. And that's why what we actually say in that third-party chapter is there are two things we'll tell you if this happens. One is the third-party guy or gal will not win. And two, they will have a bigger impact on the country than the person who does. Because what happened with Ross Perot is both parties saw, holy mackerel, 40% of the country is for that agenda? Well, that means if I want to get reelected, I better get to that space before the other guy does. That's actually what we're talking about. We do not expect a third-party candidate to win. What we do and what we need is a third-party candidate to show that there's actually a huge chunk of the country ready for this grand bargain. Life's about incentives, all right? These politicians all operate under certain incentives. And right now, they're all skewed against, I would argue, the future of the country. You know, you got to change the incentives. Move the cheese, move the mouse. Don't move the cheese, the mouse doesn't move, okay? So we need someone to show where the cheese is. And by the way, look, if I'm wrong, then we're wrong. We've misread the country completely, but I don't think so.
There's a huge portion of this country now that thinks corporate America owns our democracy, and it's not going to happen. Here's James on Facebook right. saying, when are we going to eliminate corporate funding of campaigns? And the suggestion here is that if we don't, this future is not going to happen. Is it that bound up and tied?
I have total sympathy with that question. After Citizens United case in the Supreme Court, which basically said corporations are like people and they can just give as much money as they have in their wallet, they really have, you know, created a Congress that becomes a forum for legalized bribery. And I think it's a tragedy, and we need a, I don't know what the process is, someone needs to pass a law, a constitutional amendment, we've got to get together because, yes, corporations have a huge undue influence, but let's also remember, we're not powerless, okay?
We, in this case,
we
is
the people.
The non-corporate
right,
people.
Look at the Tea Party. I mean, and I have enormous respect for the fact that these are people, they felt something, they got themselves organized, and they have actually had a huge impact in setting the agenda of the country equal to, and in many ways, maybe more so than corporations. So you can't, I don't want to put it all in that. I think the Supreme Court decision on that case was deeply flawed and wrong. But we can't just sit back and say, you know, they're all, we're owned by these people.
We've got the markets reeling in recent weeks, up and down and down and down. Lots of concern about Europe, people talking about a big tumble that would be global markets in Asia also, you know, not looking good in these last few days. And lots of unrest in the streets. We've seen it in New York, we've seen it in Boston, we've seen it around the country. Not enormous numbers at this point.
Yeah.
But I wonder about this intersection. We could have another big chunk down that would make everything worse and make the down longer. And you've got this kind of sentiment in the country. Here from Adam on Facebook. The future is the 99% rise in revolution. Occupy Wall Street will soon become Occupy the White House. Mm-hmm. And there are people who are really worried about the fundamental stability of this country if we don't get on top of it. How do you see that path?
I share their concern. I was actually in Wall Street this morning. I saw the demonstration there. I am very, very worried. I go back, Tom, to the image of driving around without a bumper and a spare tire. We cannot afford another leg down. The pain it would inflict on a country that already has probably truly, you know, almost 1 out of 5 unemployed, and for African Americans, a far higher percentage, particularly African American males, we cannot afford it. And this is why what frustrates me so much now is I pick up the paper and I say, wait a minute, we're having an economic crisis and they're having an election. And it's like two circles that don't overlap. And I ask myself, do these people live on some offshore island? Do they go home on weekends where everyone's 401k is fine, everyone's kids are doing great in school, nobody's worried about
their
pension?
You're talking about Congress people.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand why they aren't there all the time. And the same with the president. I pick up the president's doing $33,500, you know, a plate dinners or fundraising. I mean, things are okay. You actually have time to do that? Excuse me. Mm-hmm. You have no time to do that, all right? You need to be educating the country about how urgent this situation is and leverage doing the one thing he never did around the grand bargain, leveraging the public against people who are standing in the way of it. You know, Obama's people are always telling me, you don't understand, they're bad. They're much worse than we are, okay? And Friedman, you don't call the game. you won't say they're bad. You know what I mean? They're much, you're this congenital centrist, you know.
Little of this, okay? Little of that.
Well, this is public radio, so I can't actually express the word I would use to describe that. Because do I understand they're bad? Absolutely. Do I understand they've actually, many of them, tried to make Obama fail from day one? Oh, I understand that as well. But here's my question back. How come they've been getting away with it? How come they've been getting away with it? How come the rest of the country doesn't quite see it that way? It's maybe because you haven't gone out into the country and not said they're bad, but said, here is the plan. Here is the way out. And it's a plan, frankly, folks, that's going to hurt me in my base, okay? That it's not some wonderful thing that only millionaires are going to pay for. If you believe that, then I truly have a bridge in St. Paul for you, okay?
You want to line people up on a vision here. The flat world is at the heart of it. You've got people with memories. Americans remember they've read you for a long time now. And you and others. Here's a comment from Brian at Facebook. And he says, I'd love to hear you, Tom, ask Tom Friedman about the globalization trade question that you put to Bill Gross, a big bond trader from PIMCO who was on just a couple of weeks ago. For years, Friedman and Bill Gross championed global trade and outsourcing, saying it would be great for the U.S. Now we're getting the Americans have to dig deep and give up their standard of living line. All that outsourcing and automation seem to be doing is making people work harder and longer for less and less. How is it sustainable if people in Ohio are going to have to put in lower labor cost bids than people in third world nations?
The first thing, you know, I always get this because I wrote a book about you championed this. You know, actually, I actually just described it, you know, in a way that I found as I entered into the world and saw this and thought, hey, something really important is going on there. People should know about it. But I have to confess this. I didn't do this, okay? I didn't start it. I can't stop it. All I know is, and the book is full of stories about this, is you have to find a way to live with it and manage it. And there is a total flip side of this. It has never been harder to find a job. It has never been easier to invent a job. It's never been harder to start a multinational. It's never been easier to start a multinational. Okay, and the book is full of stories of people in America and India who understand this world and overnight, okay, are finding ways to get with it. Look, if horses could vote, there never would have been cars, all right? We know that. I mean, we have gone through these huge step changes before. All right? This is another one of these step changes. It's enormously challenging.
This one's different.
Oh, it is. It's
this one's got the whole globe involved, and it gets to the issue of whether or not you can, or anybody with this line, can bring the country along with them. There are people now who just don't believe it anymore.
Right.
Whether it was you or not, they did hear the line. Globalization will be good for everyone, and we'll stay at the top of the curve, and some just don't believe it, and they're not willing to bet on that square again.
No, see, globalization, my message, and I know what my message was, is that globalization is here. And our job is to get the best out of it and to cushion the worst. And it's going to give us both, okay? Now, we can go back the other way. We know what the least globalized countries in the world look like. They're called North Korea, Sudan. We know what their standard of living is like. So, obviously, we've got to find a way. And the book has four chapters on this in terms of education, jobs, innovation, in order to thrive in this world. Look, we are hardwired for this world as a country. Everything that's going on, what is our vision in the book? Our vision is that we want America to be for the 21st century what Cape Canaveral was to America in the 20th century. What was Cape Canaveral? It was the place we launched our one big national moonshot. That's not going to happen anymore. What we want America to be is the launching pad where everyone in the world will want to come to start and launch something.
Isn't that unrealistic? China's putting stuff in space now. People are launching great stuff in China. You don't have to come to the United States of America to launch great things anymore.
No,
they're being launched in a lot of places.
You don't, but you can come here if we have the best schools, the best infrastructure, the best rule of law. Do I want to go to China if I invent something? I sure don't. I want to do it here. I want to do it in this country.
Why?
Okay, because we have the best rule of law. I know my patent will be protected. I know I can call anywhere.
And then you'll build it in China. And what about my guy in Ohio who needs a job?
Right, and I may build part of it in China. I may build part of it. That's inevitable in this world. But if I'm starting things and you're starting things, I guarantee you, the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker will all have work, okay? Now, it may be, you know, higher end that we have to do all of this. Or maybe Tom Ashbrook, instead of having three people there, there'll just be one person there doing all three jobs, okay? But if there are 10 people starting those kind of companies of different kinds, there's going to be plenty of work. But here, I'll turn it back to you or the questioner. What's the alternative? Put up walls? Let's see how that works.
North Korea.
Let's have a little confidence that we can actually win and thrive in this world. It's worked out for us before. After all, that used to be us.
Let's just sit with that for a minute, because that, I think, is something that's kind of slipping away.
Yeah.
That feeling, you know, that we were the world beaters. We were the ones who developed the new technologies and made them and put them out into the world, and it was recent. We were the ones who pushed the frontier, the ingredients. Are they there now? Are they there now?
You know, if there's one section in the book, or just one little few pages, read the story, Robert Stevenson. He runs the oldest manufacturing company in Buffalo, New York. Over 100 years old, family run.
Back to Erie Canal days.
And it's a cutting. They started out cutting, you know, cloth, and now they cut wings for airplanes and for wind turbines. Mm-hmm. And it's just a great story of a guy who says, this is the world I'm in. So, yes, and he has all unionized employees, all making $50,000, $70,000 a year, okay, with full benefits, retirement, whatnot. But, yes, one employee now runs three machines instead of just one, okay? And that means he can be paid, you know, three times or 10 times whatever a Chinese laborer who's going to do it with his hands. He's used China. He's actually opened a plant in China because why? His company's called Eastman, and the Chinese completely ripped off his product. They call it Westman, okay? And so defensively, he opened up a company there. He got on the board of his local university to help them work and do research for his company, you know, and to draw on the talent he has in the neighborhood. In other words, he's a guy saying, this is the world I'm in. I'm going to figure out this world, and I'm going to thrive within it, okay? Are the old days, Tom, where, you know, I mentioned this last night, that 50 years ago in Baltimore, the biggest employer in Baltimore was Bethlehem Steel. You could get a job at Bethlehem Steel without a high school degree on the line. You could get a house, join the union, have a mortgage, raise your kids, retire. Everything would be fine. The biggest employer in Baltimore today is Johns Hopkins University Medical Center. Okay, you cannot get a job there cutting the grass without a BA, all right? And so let's remember something. 90% of jobs are not outsourced to China. They are outsourced to the past.
Outsourced to the past. And they can come again, or we remake them, we reinvent them.
The new things will come along. But we used to have a receptionist at the Washington Bureau and the New York Times. We didn't hire someone from Mexico. We got a microchip. Called voicemail.
Tom Friedman, you lay out a compelling vision. It's still got great big questions in it. They're going to be in this country's face for a long time. We'll keep listening. We'll keep reading. We're very grateful to you for being with us today. Ladies and gentlemen, with me in the hall, Thomas Friedman with Michael Mandelbaum, author of the new book, That Used to Be Us, How America Fell Behind in the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. Please join me in thanking Tom Friedman for being here today. Listeners around the country, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.